I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Yesterday, Greek voters decisively rejected a tough austerity deal from the country's creditors in a hastily called referendum. Now all eyes are on the Greek Prime Minister and the European Central Bank about what they will do next. This is a serious challenge to the 16-year-old Eurozone. Will Greece leave? Can they survive on their own with their own currency? What about other nations in the zone under economic and financial stress? Can the contagion be contained? We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Adam Feibelman is Associate Dean for Faculty Research and the Sumter Davis Marks Professor of Law at Tulane University Law School. And Adam Feibelman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Ralph Atkins. He's a capital market editor for the Financial Times. And Ralph Atkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
Adam, let me begin with you. Are you surprised at how overwhelmingly Greek voters voted no yesterday?
I guess I'm a little surprised. I thought it might be a little closer, but I really didn't, have any insights into the into the polls or the referendum process, but I'm not surprised in general in the outcome. There seemed to be real hesitation about the at least hesitation about the austerity program proposed by the Troika in Greece among voters there.
Ralph, how do you interpret what voters, the majority of voters in Greece, were saying yesterday?
I think there's a lot of sort of complex political forces going on in Greece and beyond Europe, and it's quite sort of difficult to characterize exactly what the Greek people were saying. I think in many ways it was a vote of frustration and anger and a sign of sort of the huge sort of shocks, economic shock they've gone through over the last 5 or 6 years. It was a sort of a cry, if you like, almost, which makes it much more complicated for the Eurozone as a whole to deal with.
Ralph, one of the things I was reading about this referendum was the vote was a complicated vote. It really required a fair amount of knowledge about what the creditors were offering Greece. Do you think that factored in any way into the vote?
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it sort of fueled that sort of slight sort of sense of uncertainty that people feel very much in Greece, and that they weren't quite sure what either of the options actually meant. Even if you could understand the words and the documents to which these questions referred and had looked at these documents, or there's a commission proposal, European Commission proposals for, and the creditors' proposals for Greece, it wasn't clear what a vote for them or against them would actually mean, mm-hmm. because in practice, actually, these proposals had been withdrawn by the creditors' side before the referendum, because they were not happy with the referendum going ahead in the first place. So it wasn't entirely clear what the whole question was about.
Well, and just to add to the complexity, Adam, the Prime Minister was telling people to vote no, saying he could essentially get a better deal for the Greek people. They could stay in Europe and he would get this better deal. What kind of pressure on him to deliver on that promise?
Well, you mean after the vote?
Yes,
now?
Like
yes,
now.
I think huge. I agree with Ralph that, I had difficulty figuring out exactly what the people were supposed to be voting on in precise detail. And so it's possible that, as the Prime Minister said, they were being asked to vote on a better deal, although it seems like perhaps some people thought that they were voting against austerity entirely, which seems, an unlikely outcome. So the best read is that taking the Prime Minister at his word was that he was hoping that a no vote would give him the opportunity to kind of return to the table in negotiating with the Eurozone leaders, which it sounds like he's busy doing now.
And Ralph, I wonder, the negotiators on the other side of the table, are they interested in negotiating with this prime minister? It's interesting that the finance minister resigned and had said some pretty, inflammatory things about the people he was negotiating with. Does that open a door to negotiation that might not have been there in the past?
I'd say it's a sort of complex, very political situation, actually. I think it's very difficult to try and sort of rationalize these things sort of economically, which is partly why sort of financial markets have had quite a difficulty dealing with this. I mean, I think the problems with both sides is that it was unclear whether this was a vote about austerity or whether it was a vote about Greece's membership of the Eurozone. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, from Alexis Tsipras' point of view, the Greek Prime Minister, that they're not inconsistent. And what he wants is Greece to stay within the Eurozone and without austerity. It's about much more than just austerity. It's about an economic reform program. But, of course, to the international creditors, what they want is, what they argue they need is a sort of a viable program for Greece, which requires savings, and that is not without that they find sort of continuing membership of the Eurozone much more difficult to imagine. On the other hand, the international creditors, they also want to have their cake and eat it, because they know that that Greece leaving the Eurozone would be intensely damaging to the whole Eurozone and the whole image of the Eurozone economic integration project. So it's both sides sort of want to sort of have the impossible, really, which makes this much more complicated. On the personalities, as I say, it's political. It is much more political. I think what the real problem in the past few weeks has been this complete breakdown in trust between the two sides. You have this sort of fiery, left-wing, youthful, almost sort of revolutionary government in Greece that sort of instinctively wants to stand up and fight, be the revolutionaries within the Eurozone, and they feel they have this sort of mission. And that sort of sits completely at odds with the way that Europe has sort of done business for the past 15 years, which is based on sort of consensus and lengthy negotiations, but sort of rational arguments that lead eventually to a sort of a solution acceptable to sort of the majority. And there's been that sort of clash between these sort of two sort of different, very different approaches. Syriza, the lead party in Greece, being very much a product of all the pain and the economic pain that Greece has suffered over the past 5 years.
Adam, do you think whatever deal is worked out, but it is going to ask for at least some austerity measures, yes, that might help the banks and it might get some of the money flowing, but at the same time, does that allow Greece to begin to rebuild from, you know, the last, 10 years, 5 years certainly of difficult financial woes?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not an economist, I should be quick to say, but my sense is that most people, most kind of commentators and the majority of policymakers involved seem to have kind of coalesced around the idea that some type, package of economic reforms, as as Ralph accurately calls them, and some degree of debt relief or debt reprofiling, again at this stage, is probably, the right mix of approaches or policies to help Greece, stabilize and move forward. But getting to that consensus through the machinery of kind of Eurozone policymaking, I think, will be very, very difficult, but not impossible.
Adam, do you think this in any way hastens Greece's exit or being booted out of the Eurozone? Or is it too soon to tell?
I think it's still too soon to tell. I mean, I definitely think that, again, as just an observer from far away, that the prospect of Greece leaving the Eurozone, the kind of chances of that did dramatically increase over the last week or so, and increased again with the referendum. But I still think we're many steps away. First of all, my sense is that the vast majority of people in Greece don't want to leave the Euro. For a Grexit, so to speak, that would have to be involuntary. In other words, the Eurozone would presumably have to remove them. And there is no, as far as I understand, no machinery in place to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that the Eurozone leaders and policymakers couldn't come up with the machinery to do that, but I'm not sure that's what they want either. So I suspect we'll see at least, you know, some significant maneuvering to try to avoid that still.
And we should say to our listeners a new word coined in the last couple of weeks called Grexit, yeah, which is the amalgam of Greek exit. Let me toss to you, Ralph, the same question. I mean, do you see this as opening the door a little bit more to Greece either leaving or being booted out of the Eurozone?
I have to say, Grexit, it's not a new word. Grexit was started from 2012. We had all this 3 years ago, remember?
Oh, yes, we did.
And the European Central Bank came in then, and the German government decided they wanted to keep Greece within the Eurozone. And since then, they've done an awful lot to improve the architecture of the Eurozone, to strengthen the finances of the banks, to make sure they have sort of policy instruments and everything ready. And banks have had time to prepare for the possibility that this might happen, to think about their exposures and so on. So the dangers of Grexit.
Word. Yes.
Yes. Well, I suppose my point is that the dangers of this have been sort of well flagged up. I think it's a sort of complex situation. Yes, you can say that maybe the probability of Grexit has increased in the past few weeks, although I don't know quite how you can possibly measure that. But it is also true that both sides, the international creditors and Greece themselves, do not want that to happen. It's a matter of trying to square that circle, and how do you get a sort of reform plan in place in Greece that's acceptable to the Greek people, whilst keeping them and keep them with, whilst sort of meeting the demands and the requirements of their international creditors. And it's a bit of a, it requires some sequencing, because the creditors accept there may have to be some sort of debt relief at some point. But they argue that Greece has to put its reform plans in place first and prove that it can have a sustainable economic model before they will consider the debt relief, whereas, of course, the Greek government wants it the other way around. So, yes, I think perhaps we are closer to Grexit. Whether it's going to happen, I think it's far from clear.
Well, we're almost up in a break here, but just picking up on what you just said there, Ralph, is it a sort of a reputational thing that if Greece were to leave somehow, that would reflect poorly on the Eurozone and its
absolutely
leaders?
Yeah. I mean, the Euro is meant to be irreversible. It's not a sort of a two-way membership. Once you're in, it's meant to be permanent. Of course, if Greece left, then the question would be, might another country follow at some point in the future? And as soon as you get that sort of element of doubt, you're then open to the risk of sort of financial attack or financial speculation that eventually becomes self-fulfilling. That's the big risk. I mean, having said that, of course, I think Greece is such an exceptional situation these days, so the combination of the politics and the weak economy and so on makes it quite unlike any other Eurozone country. So at least for a time, I don't think there would be a great danger of that, but it would certainly be the worry at the back of everyone's minds.
And that's Ralph Atkins, Capital Markets Editor for the Financial Times. Also with us, Adam Feibelman, and Associate Dean for Faculty Research, also the Sumter Davis Marks Professor of Law at Tulane University Law School. We are talking about what Greek voters did yesterday and what's ahead for the Eurozone. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are talking about the ever-unfolding situation in Greece, the effect it's having on the Eurozone, what it means for the world economy, and again, talking with Ralph Atkins and Adam Feibelman. And you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Be curious about your thoughts as you watch what's happening in Europe. Adam, if I can go back to you, do you think, is this a real, maybe the first real test for the Eurozone, what's happening today?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of a test that, you know, began in the wake of the global financial crisis. But certainly that, you know, the kind of situation in Greece since, you know, say 2008, has Greece as an episode has been, I think, the first greatest test of the Eurozone project. As Ralph alluded to, it has spurred a lot of important reforms in the kind of legal, especially legal architecture in the Eurozone, the creation of a single union-wide bank resolution mechanism, bank supervisory mechanism, other similar types of reforms that are part of a kind of new banking union, mm-hmm. Which have, I think Ralph is right, reduced the potential fallout of, you know, even a worst case scenario in Greece significantly, but it still, I think, underscores some of the kind of incompleteness of the monetary union that you know many people have noticed since the beginning, and presses on some of those kind of weak spots quite dramatically.
Ralph, do you agree with that? That this crisis is exposing, or I guess continues the exposure of some of the weaknesses in the Eurozone?
Yes, it does. It does, and I suppose I'm a bit skeptical about saying this is the first big crisis mm-hmm. the Eurozone has faced. I mean, it's sort of faced up and down. I mean, remember, this is a project that was sort of the dream, first dreamt of back in the 1950s, you know, after the end of the Second World War, and in the original foundation stones for the European Union were being put in place. I mean, I followed this process since the 1990s, and there's always sort of issues and conflicts and setbacks and so on, and then sort of you get a then big step forward, and I would see it more in that context. I think it's a sort of a learning process. This is quite a sort of unique project we've never had before in history as such. And yes, there are weaknesses, but I think the sort of the political will for European Economic Union remains pretty strong and will drive this forward.
Well, Ralph, let me ask you a very practical question, because the banks in Greece are closed. People are taking limited amounts of money out of their ATMs. I mean, at some point, and it might be within the next couple of days, there is not going to be money in these banks or access to money. How much pressure is that putting on the Eurozone leaders?
Well, a lot. You could maybe the question should be put the other way around. How much pressure is it putting on Alexis Tsipras, the
yes.
Greek Prime Minister? maybe, although he pretends he has the upper hand, or says he has the upper hand with this no vote. As we said earlier, we weren't quite clear what this vote was actually for or against. He says he has a mandate now to take a tougher negotiating stance with the Eurozone creditors. It's quite interesting that's been going on today, which is basically the creditors have not really done anything yet today. We've got a meeting tomorrow. We're going to no signs of any sort of great rush to offer any great new terms or anything. I think they're waiting for Mr. Tsipras to come up with his terms, which he's hinted might not be too different from what they're actually proposing. So maybe the pressure for a deal is actually being applied to the Greek government.
Well, I guess time will tell, Adam, whether that was a smart move on the part of the Prime Minister to have this referendum. I mean, it was pulled together, I think, in about a week's time. How do you see, the politics of this?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that there are politics in Greece, you know, and then there are domestic politics in the other countries of the international lenders, in Germany and in France. I think my sense is there are concerns about the effect of the strength of the no vote on other kind of political movements in Europe, especially leftist political movements in Europe that are, if not kind of anti-European, then you know much less enthusiastic about the European project or some of its policy orientations now. But that's a bit beyond mm-hmm. kind of my area of.
Mm. It must look incredibly confusing from your side of the Atlantic. I do apologize.
It's not your fault, Ralph, that we're all confused, but perhaps it's by design. I don't know, but we're talking about obviously a complicated financial
yeah.
system that yeah. has some problems.
You're talking about many different financial systems and many different
yeah.
political systems as well, despite all the economic integration and the adoption of a common currency. There are, as Adam rightly identifies, there's a huge amount of variations in the politics across the continent, which makes it difficult and nerve-wracking viewing sometimes.
Adam, you want to weigh in on that? Go ahead.
Well, I do think that It does underscore one important point that I think is often lost when we have these kinds of government financial crises and sovereign debt crises, which is that at some point the kind of will of the people who are affected, or their capacity, the people who are affected, is a relevant factor, if only as a practical matter. And that, you know, you can't strike a deal that is going to lead to, say, the end of the government that struck the deal. Whether this was a good idea or a bad idea, it does provide a moment to remember that there is an important kind of democratic component to this, at least as a far backstop.
I think that's a very important. One of the weaknesses within the euro is this sort of sense of democratic legitimacy. And that's why, in a way, the one good thing to come out of this process, it's been a bit cathartic. It's made people sort of decide, you know, what they really want. Do they really want the euro? Do they really want the loss of sovereignty by individual countries, as it implies, when you give up monetary policy to a single European Central Bank and you have a single monetary policy?
But isn't that, Ralph, the system?
Yeah, absolutely, and there's no sort of way out of it. I mean, that's the problem for the Greeks. During the pre-crisis years, the Greek economy was benefited. I'm not sure if benefit is quite the right word, but it sort of inflated enormously by cheap loans from the rest of the eurozone at low interest rates. It expanded its public sector far more than was healthy. It paid its civil servants. It paid its pensioners. Everyone far more than with hindsight was perhaps justified, and now it's paying the penalty. So it didn't apply the rules before the crisis, and it paid the price afterwards.
And that's Ralph Atkins, capital markets editor for the Financial Times, Adam Feibelman, associate dean for faculty research, and the Sumter Davis Marks professor of law at Tulane University Law School. We are trying to make sense of the vote yesterday in Greece, the fate of Greece and its debt, and certainly the fate of the eurozone as well. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be talking about an issue here in the other side of the Atlantic having to do with Puerto Rico and its debt. In the meantime, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times about your thoughts about what's happening in Europe as we speak. Let me get David from Roxborough to join us on Radio Times. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I have a degree in economics.
Okay.
But you don't need a degree in economics. You just need to get a C in freshman economics to remember that Keynesian economics states, mainstream economics states, that when you have high unemployment, you do the exact opposite of austerity. That was the basis of Obama's stimulus plan. Was he wrong to do that? Number two, what you've left out are numbers to when you call austerity. What does austerity mean? Well, austerity in Greece right now is applied to a country that has an unemployment rate that is worse than it ever was during the depths of our Great Depression in 32 and 33.
About 25%.
25%. We were going through a crisis when our unemployment rate was 10%. Double that and increase that 25% more. How could we and the plutocrats that bailed out their banks want to crucify a nation of 12 million men, women, and children to make things worse with no end in sight? People should talk about what this really means to real living people. Could you endure a situation like that? I couldn't.
No, I think it's a very valid point, and the banks are closed, obviously.
No, I'm talking about the banks.
Policies. No, I understand, but people want access to their own money, and they can't get it in probably the amounts that they need. And you're absolutely correct about unemployment. The economy has contracted in extraordinary amounts. I think the youth unemployment, Ralph, is something like 50%. I hear the argument coming from our caller saying that austerity is not the solution. You need government investment, and that will help bring the economy around. Ralph?
this is why I hesitated about using the word austerity, because it's not just about slashing public spending. The problem with Greece goes much broader than that. It needs to have a properly functioning modern government in the way that we understand a modern government, in terms of basic things like being able to collect tax revenue, being able to operate efficiently, ending systems of patronage and corruption, frankly, across a lot of the economy. And that's what the aim of the reforms has been to. In a way, it's almost sort of like sort of basic nation building, having a sort of a functioning modern economy. And that there has been some progress on that, but there's still some sort of basic things that need to be sorted out in terms of making Greece a functioning economy. In fact, I'm not going to be a defender for the international creditors. I mean, it's not my job. I'm a reporter. But, I mean, you know, there has been an enormous amount of European Union and foreign money that has gone into Greece. And, in fact, the debt terms, the debt servicing costs have been cut massively. But what's needed to, I mean, it's a sense of pride almost for the Greeks themselves that they need to create a sort of a self-funding, a self-sustaining economy. They can't just sort of, they don't want to have to rely on foreign subsidies. What? And that's what it's about. And, it's in a way, it's a failure by the politicians. Of Greek politicians to putting in place the reforms that are so desperately needed because of all the problems that your caller pointed out quite rightly.
Yeah, and David, I appreciate the call. Adam, anything you want to add to that?
Not really. I think it is important to emphasize that the program is a combination of reforms on both the spending and the revenue side, and that we shouldn't for a second, kind of downplay at all the human impact of all of this on people in Greece. It is just a terrible situation to be in, and one that's compounded greatly by the uncertainty now that that seems quite acute. But I think the fact of the matter is that however it's done in whatever framework, there are going to have to be dramatic changes in structural fiscal changes there on both spending and the revenue side. At least that seems to be the broad agreement. And so the question now is one of timing and sequencing and how much of the cost of this should be allocated within the country, and how much should be allocated beyond its borders to the international creditors. That's the difficult project.
Well, Ralph, and just picking up on what you both have just said, I mean, is it possible then to preserve the Eurozone and not just save Greece's current crisis, but also help to reduce this unemployment rate of 25%. Is it possible to do all of that?
Yes, it's not going to be easy, and it may not happen. But I think if agreement was possible with the Greek government, if the both sides can come to a deal that addresses the sort of structural weaknesses in the Greek economy, that puts in place a program that will create economic growth and eventually leads to a reduction in their debt burden, then I think absolutely the Greek economy. Remember, a year ago, the Greek economy was back on path to grow again, and it was, you could start to see the beginnings of the turnaround. But then we had the election of this government at the beginning of the year, and the enormous uncertainty that the past few months have caused. All that has created a huge slump in the economy. As a result of the politics. So I think if the agreement could be struck, then yes, the Eurozone could be put back on a growth path. And you look in countries like Portugal, Spain particularly, the economy is doing very well. Ireland has turned around itself completely from the crisis years.
Well, and how much, this came up earlier, but how much do you think, Ralph, and then we're going to have to say goodbye to you in just a couple of minutes, but how much of the problem now is about trust, about the negotiators on whatever side of the table, is that they trust the person opposite them?
I think there's a lot about that. I mean, and this is why it's interesting that Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek finance minister, resigned today. A lot of people interpreting this as an olive branch being sent out from by Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, to try and put relations with his international creditors back on a much better footing, in the hope that we can reach a deal in the next, at least a temporary deal in the next few days and going forward in the next few weeks.
And Ralph, how much is Angela Merkel and Germany, how much is she calling the shots?
A lot. I mean, Angela Merkel is obviously in an extremely powerful position, facing a lot of political pressures herself, because there's an awful lot of Germans who think that Greece no longer deserves to be part of the Eurozone, believes a sort of, even on a sort of a pure sort of mathematical looking at the numbers, thinks that actually Germany better off cutting its losses now. On the other hand, enormous strong commitment within within Germany, as in across most of the Eurozone, commitment to economic integration and to the euro. It being a very important symbol of the European Union in the 21st century.
And final question, what will you be looking for, watching for, waiting for this week?
Well, signs of an agreement. Crucial role in the meantime is going to be what the European Central Bank does in terms of continuing emergency support for Greek banks. Any sort of troubles in that could make things much more difficult.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Ralph Atkins, for joining us today on Radio Times to talk about what's been happening in the Eurozone.
My pleasure.
And he's capital markets editor for the Financial Times. Adam Feibelman is going to stay with us for the rest of the hour. He's associate dean for faculty research, also the Sumter Davis Marks Professor of Law at Tulane University Law School. And we are shifting gears talking about Puerto Rico and its struggles to pay off its mounting debt. And we have a guest from the Wall Street Journal, Adam Kurloff, to join us on Radio Time. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We've been talking about Greece's debt problems and what's been happening in the Eurozone. Well, let's focus now on a crisis closer to home. Puerto Rico's governor announced that the Commonwealth's $72 billion debt was too much, and it would not be able to pay back some of the money it owed. And joining us now is Alan Kurloff, Wall Street Journal reporter who has been covering municipal bonds and public finance. Aaron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And Adam Feibelman staying with us for the rest of the hour. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking now about Puerto Rico. And let me go back to you, Aaron, but I'll get you in on the conversation, Adam, as well. How did Puerto Rico get itself in such debt?
Well, Puerto Rico last week released a report by some former IMF officials and economists that sort of tracked this story. And what they said were there are both structural economic problems on the island and some problems with debt and government spending and borrowing. So in a long story short, it started in about 2006, the most recent set of problems, when a bunch of IRS tax breaks for manufacturing expired and weren't renewed, and a lot of manufacturing left the island. And that coincided with a lot of economic problems that we experience here in the mainland also, including a big housing bust, the damage of which really still isn't fully calculated over there, a recession that was worse in Puerto Rico, it says, than in the mainland, bank distress and credit crunch that affected their banks, just like our banks here. They use oil to run most of their electrical generators, and oil prices doubled effectively between 2005 and 2012. Because of the island's unique status as neither a commonwealth nor a state nor a sovereign nation, they have access to the $3.7 trillion municipal bond market, which is how U.S. states and municipal governments finance a lot of their projects. It's a great way for your local school board to build a new school, and it gives incentivizes U.S. investors to buy debt from state and local governments by giving them a tax break. So they took advantage of that unique status, which allows Puerto Rico debt to be tax-free in both federal, state, and local taxes. And that created a big incentive to buy Puerto Rico debt, which had a little bit higher yields than, you know, debt from your hometown, maybe. And it was tax-exempt everywhere, thus creating a huge market for it.
I mean, a confluence of a number of events. Adam, you're our connector here. Do you see some parallels between what's been happening with Greece and what's going on with Puerto Rico?
Well, there's some very important parallels. And I think Puerto Rico is interesting both for its, you know, its similarities with the Greek predicament and its dissimilarities. But I don't want to get too ahead of the story, but certainly part of the kind of story of the buildup of vulnerabilities and instability is similar, that both are part of, kind of broader currency monetary unions, the Puerto Rico, the U.S. obviously, and Greece, the euro, which, among other things, made it easier for them to access credit markets to the extent that they did, with the idea that, you know, they were part of the broader union in some respects. In Puerto Rico's case, the kind of important tie, as Aaron mentioned, was the tax benefits accorded to their bonds.
Well, and one thing I stumbled upon in doing some homework for today's show is while we talk about the Eurozone in Europe, and I'll put this to you, Aaron, people talk about the dollar zone on this side of the Atlantic. Is that if we're talking about Puerto Rico, obviously uses the U.S. dollar. Is this a dollar zone we're talking about?
Well, what investors have mostly been afraid of is the impact on the broader market for debt sold by U.S. cities and states, that municipal bond market. I haven't reported any threat to the dollar, but that's not really my area. The issue is that to the extent that it might affect the market for debt sold by U.S. cities and states, it could drive up borrowing costs nationwide. Now, that said, last week, after the governor made this dramatic announcement and this report appeared, municipal bonds did not appear significantly affected. In fact, they were mostly trading, according to the investors I spoke to, on the news out of Greece rather than and the Federal Reserve rather than Puerto Rico.
Is that because we have sort of some built-in safety structures with our economy, Aaron?
Yeah, well, it's funny. The municipal bond market is a very esoteric place where things are very what they call, things depend very much on what they call credit, like a single issue or a single government entity. So as what happened in Detroit, when Detroit declared bankruptcy, there was not a panic sell-off of debt from all over the nation because Detroit was an isolated situation with its own problems. In the same way, Puerto Rico, despite being widely held by individuals and mutual funds historically, has really been developing over a number of years, and a lot of mutual funds and a lot of individuals have sold their debt on to hedge funds and other buyers of distressed debt who are more able to deal with the uncertainty of the current situation and more willing to do the things you have to do to sort of recover a maximal value in the case of a big debt restructuring like this.
Adam, just picking up what Aaron was just saying, talking about Puerto Rico, obviously it's not a state, it's not a city, certainly not Detroit, but it can't declare bankruptcy. Can you sort of expand on that for us?
Yeah, so that's what, is one of the important and interesting similarities between the Puerto Rico and the Greek situation, which is that they're both what my friend Anna Gelpern at Georgetown likes to say, are quasi-sovereign. So they're both – so Puerto Rico for, kind of bankruptcy purposes is treated like a state, basically. And a state in the U.S. can't file for bankruptcy. A municipality can under Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Code. So Puerto Rico looks like a little bit more like a state, which, is kind of you know, we would think is in similarly situated to a sovereign nation, which can't avail itself of a formal legal bankruptcy process. But the tricky thing, you know, for both Greece, but in this case, even more so for Puerto Rico, is that it has even less room to maneuver, it seems, than if it were a sovereign state. So, a completely independent nation. So there was a recent effort in Puerto Rico, as I understand, to kind of create the machinery for some type of debt restructuring down the road, and that was deemed not to be preempted under federal bankruptcy law. In other words, under the Constitution, Congress has the authority to write bankruptcy law, and states can't go and kind of create their own. So Puerto Rico's caught between these two. It's treated as a state for purposes of kind of excluding it from Chapter 9, but it can't do, you know, anything on its own to try to create a process for restructuring its debt. So there are efforts underway. There's a bill, as I understand, in Washington that would allow Puerto Rico to avail itself of Chapter 9. And there are two possible ways that it could do so. It's some of its utilities that actually issued debt independently could be eligible for Chapter 9, or, you know, in theory, Puerto Rico itself could. Wow. But I think those are both now going to, you know, be kind of given possibilities, going to be given serious consideration going forward.
Well, Aaron, if you can just pick up on that, I mean, what options do you see Puerto Rico having?
Well, they've been working hard on that issue, as Adam said. Last summer, around this time, they passed what they called the Recovery Act, which would have allowed the Sewer Authority, the Electrical Power Authority, and the Highway Authority in particular to restructure the debts in what was similar to a Chapter 9 process, and creditors disagreed strongly about how fair that process was, as outlined in that law.
Sure.
It was thrown out in court, has been appealed, and is sort of awaiting a verdict on, a judgment on the appeal. There is a Chapter 9 bill in Congress put there by the Puerto Rico's non-voting congressional representative. It got a hearing. It hasn't advanced much further than that. What the situation now would look like, according to various people I've talked to, is each possible default or restructuring would be subject to the individual bond covenants. And you're talking about, thousands, maybe. It's some incredible number. I mean, there's maybe 17 different issuers in Puerto Rico and bonds going back, you know, numbers of years. So a Chapter 9 process, a lot of people have said, would make things more predictable and understandable. But a lot of people say that, well, there's, you know, depending on your creditor, there's people who own the debt that say, well, the covenants as outlined in the bond documents should be fine. Why can't we just use those?
I mean, but short of bankruptcy, I mean, can they get rid of $72 billion worth of debt, Aaron?
Well, what the governor called for last week was a consensual negotiation with bondholders to do some things like extend maturities and so the bonds wouldn't be paid back as quickly as they said. They'd be paid back over a longer period of time. That would be a negotiated process, and that's what we've seen so far in the discussion over the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, which was able to make a bond payment last week, largely because it was able to negotiate a deal with its creditors to have them put up some of the money in exchange for yet another bond. There's some people hoping that could be a model for how the rest of the restructuring could unfold, but obviously it's sort of midstream there, and we don't know what the end of that would look like.
Well, Adam, let me throw another issue in for discussion. Mm-hmm. Will this in any way affect a desire for Puerto Rico, for instance, to become a state? I mean, does that put this question off the table, or is it still on the table in spite of these difficulties?
You know, I think that is a great question, and one that I've been kind of curious about, and was recently in Puerto Rico, kind of spying as a tourist. curious about precisely that question: you know, how this debt crisis will impact the kind of ongoing politics of the of the island, right. Which ranges. There are people who like being a territory. There are people who want to think they should be a state, and people who think they should become independent from the U.S. I have no insights into how this is actually affecting public opinion, but it is. I have to think that it is kind of putting these questions into sharper relief. Depending on how things play out, so far this has been kind of at the level of, kind of government to creditors. I don't have a sense of how deep the precise aspects of this, the kind of over-indebtedness crisis is reaching into the population. But the more salient that becomes, depending on how this process unfolds, I think that it's entirely, it'd be surprising to me that it wouldn't have some impact on the kind of the politics of these questions of statehood, independence, and so forth.
And a couple minutes before I have to say goodbye, I have a couple of practical questions for you. My understanding is that in Puerto Rico, they have the same minimum wage rules, I guess, that we have here on the mainland, that a lot of their goods and supplies that come from the United States, they have to pay high wages because this thing called the Jones Act requiring the use of American vessels, and that's more expensive, and this is a commonwealth, I should say, where there's a pretty high unemployment rate and people are leaving the island. Well, how does that all figure into this discussion, or does it?
It does. The report identified, in fact, those three specific things that you just mentioned as being significant structural problems for Puerto Rico. One is it is subject to U.S. Minimum wage and, regulations pertaining to overtime, paid vacation, et cetera. And that's not necessarily Puerto Rico's request. That was actually, in fact, lobbied for at one point, according to the report, by unions on the mainland that saw a lower minimum wage in Puerto Rico as being too much competition. They also have U.S.-style welfare benefits, which, again, like the minimum wage, are quite high relative to the general typical earnings there. So the result, according to the report there, is a massive, what they say is a massive underutilization of labor and a big gray economy where people sort of work off the books and taxes aren't collected. The Jones Act is one thing people have pointed to as a possible help the federal government could do without too much trouble is exempting Puerto Rico from the Jones Act, which means that its costs of power production, for example, which requires oil transported on ships, would go down because they'd have to pay less. That's another thing that would require federal action, and we haven't seen any yet.
Well, stay tuned, I guess. Adam Kurloff, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And he's a Wall Street Journal reporter covering municipal bonds and public finance. Adam Feibelman, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Associate Dean for Faculty Research and the Sumter Davis Marks Professor of Law at Tulane University Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Claire Moran is our summer intern. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.